Our next presenter for this session, or our presenter for this session, is Dr. Dave Daly, the other CSU, Chico State University in California. Dave did go through the other Colorado State CSU for some of his education. Very well known throughout the industry, made a big impact in awareness of the topics that he'll talk about. Dave warned me that he likes to wander a little bit. We don't have a, as he speaks, maybe he wanders other ways too, but we don't have a lapel mic for him. I've asked him to at least stay where, but his voice, I think, carries pretty well. So, Dave, we'll turn the time to you. I think the slides are up and going, or I'll get them there while you begin. Then I'll get out of your way.
I'll let you get him started. Morning. Thanks, Dr. Whittier. And thanks, Dr. Patterson, I think, because he actually asked me, come in and visit with you, have a great time, let's have a good discussion, and hopefully make you think a little bit, and that means to make you think I may not always make you comfortable. And that's all right. This isn't an issue that I'm going to solve, certainly, and it's certainly one that I think we all find challenging. But we raise this title as, have we lost the argument on animal welfare, or how have we lost the argument on animal welfare? Have we lost it? Did I hear yes or no? No, we won? We won? Oh, that's good to know.
I just was told by the AV people that if you want or don't speak into this, you're not going to be carried through. So you do need to stay in range.
I'm on a tether, folks. He just told me. Stay here close.
Heard you around.
That's fine. I'll stay here. But let's think about that. You know what we do at most of these events, and I'm just as guilty as you, they make you feel good. There are going to be 6,000 people here who agree with each other. That's a good feeling. Damn, there's a lot of us. Right? I get that. Let alone there's 38 million people in California alone. 54 of the congressmen in the United States of 435 come from our state, maybe 55 now. There's an impact there. I don't think I'm any smarter than any of you in this room, but I do have a different set of experiences, and it's partially because of what I do and where I grew up and how I've been raised. I had a really good friend who was... an elder statesman in the farm advisor world years ago in California named Monty Bell. Do you remember Monty, Gary? Classic. One of the best. One of the best. And he told me one time, Dave, he says, Dave, some ranchers have 30 years of experience. And some ranchers have the same experience 30 years in a row. Be careful which one you're talking to, because it makes a difference. So I'm not here to tell you you're wrong. In fact, I don't even know what's right on this issue, but I do know there's a changing social ethic about animals in this country. And you can't deny it. You may want to go back. You may want to say it's not real. You may want to say it doesn't exist. But the things that I grew up doing and take for granted and seem very real to me that I cannot perceive as anybody thinking them as cruel to animals are not the way they're perceived by many others. And that's hard for us to accept. And I call that kind of getting out of our window. Let's see if this will advance.
We got it?
Should that one, that button.
I tried it. Whoop, yeah, we got it. So let's just go through this in a little bit. I want to talk on just a few issues, and I'd like to keep it informal. And if I really offend you and you want to say something, that's great. If you have a question as we go through it. Because I don't think that this is a technical talk. This is a discussion. Part of this is about communication, and how do most of us like to communicate? We want to talk, we don't want to listen. It's just the way it is. We have our point. I just asked the young ladies here from Kansas State and Texas A&M, do they ever have any animal rights people come to their campus? What was the answer? Yeah. Absolutely. There's not a campus in America that does not, that come and hand out literature. And I can usually tell the day because the students all go pick up the literature and put it on my desk and say, what are we going to do about it? You know, they want to go back and argue with them. They want to communicate. They want to tell their story. If I hear that one more time, I'll get a headache. You know, we're going to tell our story. Well, somewhere in this process, we need to also learn to listen to people and understand where they're coming from. So communication is a two-way street. And I think we talk a lot, we communicate very poorly, and we don't listen very well at all. It's just who we are. It's our nature. And it's everybody. You want to get your point across. If somebody comes up and says, you're being cruel to animals when you brand them, doesn't it just kind of piss you off? I mean, it just makes you mad. You want to come back and tell them what's wrong with them. And you, the more defensive you get, the louder you get, and the more sure you're right. And while you're thinking about what you're going to say, you aren't listening to what they're going to say because you really don't care what they think because they're already wrong. That's not communication. The old story I use on communication, and my son hates it, but he's 25 now and he's not here, so he won't hear the story. Years ago, it was my day to drop him off at daycare. He was 5 or 6 years old. I don't remember. First grade, that's it. And I drove a Dodge truck, a loud one. I don't hear very well now, and I didn't hear very well then. It was a flatbed, made a lot of noise, very fossil fuel inefficient, lots of greenhouse gases. We were ruining everything all at once. But as I put, and you take him to daycare, that's a very safe spot, right? You aren't going to do that or else you're bad parents. In fact, we don't even call it daycare, whatever the hell we call it to make ourselves feel good. Anyway, Kathy was where he was going to go. She's a great lady. We'd known her a long time. And right next to her place, there was a big cyclone fence. And that was the neighbor. And you check the cyclone fence to make sure how high it is and how solid it is, because there was a big Doberman there named Thor. And every time you pulled up, Thor would hit the fence, snarling. You know, it's like, we hope the fence is right. You know, he doesn't belong there, but we hope that's a good fence. So Kyle's getting out. He's walking. And it's like, you got your lunch. You got your homework. You got this. You got that. And he goes, Thor's a good dog. I said, yeah, Thor's a really good dog. Look at him. He's ready to bite your head off. He goes, the only problem is he'll rip your balls off. I said, pardon me? Yeah, he goes, doesn't matter. Football, baseball, basketball, he'll rip your balls off. We were talking, but we weren't communicating. And I sometimes think our discussion on animal welfare goes that way in terms of communication. So there is a loss of public trust. We may not want to admit that, but it's there. And it doesn't mean everyone. It doesn't mean the beef sector alone. I'm talking animal protein in general. There's a loss of public trust. And it's not as severe. I mean, demand's still good. People like our product. They want to trust us. They really care about what we do. They think we're doing the right thing. But if you watch what I watch in the education system, and that's at ag schools that are well known, imagine if you're going to go to Wellesley or Brown or Harvard or Princeton, where there's no balance whatsoever, and the message that we are portraying and how we respond to it. So I want to talk a little bit about loss of public trust and how much of that we're to blame. I want to talk about the problem in the cattle business, and let's not exaggerate it. Let's not make it worse than it is, because although that's kind of a provocative statement, have we lost the battle or we have lost the battle, I don't think that's necessarily true. But I think in terms of the social ethic of animal, we're close to losing that, if it is a battle. And maybe it's not at all. And then I'd like to share a little data on what we found producers think about these issues. And let's make sure that our solution to some of these challenges aren't worse than the problem. So where I have to start with this, come on, go ahead. Why isn't it going? One more. Everybody has a window on every issue they look at. You can't help it. And I'm sorry, I'm not going to put it up there. You've been to too many classes where they show you the bell curve, but we are a bell curve on every issue. And animal welfare is no different. Animal rights is no different. On one extreme, and I'll use my left hand intentionally, are people who think they have a soul and should have the right to vote. Okay? And there are people who are out there. On the other extreme, and you might be in the room, is there my damn property and I'll do what I want. Right? And in between, there's a great mass of people who have different opinions. And how, whatever I say, whatever someone says to you depends on what your window is. And you can't change that. And it's not just about animal welfare. It's about environmental issues. It's about social justice. It's about whatever you think. It's our window. It's our value system. And we think the rest of the world should view it from the same window. And frankly, they don't. This is my window. This is how I was raised. This is our summer permit. I have to spend like 5 minutes to give any California credibility that I actually know something about a cow. Because if you come from California, you automatically are in a hole that you can't know anything about cows if that's where you're from. So this is a picture of our summer country that we've been taking cattle to since 1850. It's about 100,000 acres of rough U.S. Forest Service and logging company ground. And it's my background. It's my heritage. It's what I do. So that's my window on the world. It's a browse range. We've got a permit for 400 pair. We're down with drought, probably running 600 cows at home. That's my kids and me. And we have the capacity to build that back. It's not what you think of when you think of California. It just isn't. I know that. You forget, sorry, I hate to say this when I'm in Texas, but you forget we're the number one ag state. You know, it is what it is. We're twice as much agriculture as any other state in the country. But I know what we're known for. It's fruits and nuts, and we aren't always talking about almonds and walnuts. I get it. So that's the same picture kind of. We're actually... Don't tell the Forest Service we're still out a few head in this country. It's been such a strange winter for us out there. But that's what I do in the summertime. Just a few pictures to get context. This is our winter country, which is kind of the foothills of California on the east side of the Sacramento Valley. Kind of a traditional Western ranch in many regards. And again, my family's been doing this there since 1850. So here's kind of a bad early spring last spring. But we have exceptionally soft winter country and really tough summer country. That's our world. And everybody's different on how they think. And I kind of grew up around cattle. This is late spring before we're going to the mountains. I kind of grew up around cattle. Some like you, it's like, well, we're going to brand calves today. If I wear a really light-colored shirt, I can get some blood on me and look like I did something. You know, when you're 5 years old. You know? And it's like, yeah, look how hard I worked. That's not the students I now have. Okay? That actually sounds really strange to them. But it's why things that I do, they don't even affect me. They don't register that it could be strange or different or perceived differently by somebody else. But it is. People are different in how they look at the world. But times are changing. We know that. Although I cut off her head in this picture, that's my daughter who's a freshman in vet school at Colorado State. Severely missing riding after cows right now. It's tough. But the new generation, and I put this in for a reason, those are my three. The one on the left is back on the ranch, graduated from college, and thank God, because now I can go do things like this. The one on the right is the young lady in vet school. The one on the front is 17. What is he doing on his phone when we're gathering cows? Facebook and texting. Can you imagine the generation we're now in terms of what we do and how the world's changed? Are we ready for it? Can we adapt to it? It's a different time and a different world. So I want to talk about, let me back up one. See the top there? This is my 30 years of experience. So my dad would say, what? He's 88. And until about 3 months ago was still gathering cows. Now he's got some health issues. Okay? He'd say, what are you even talking about this for? You know, that's ridiculous. You know, we do things well. You know, we should feel good about what we do. It's the right thing we do. We're growing food, and that should take precedence over everything else. Anybody ever feel that way? Absolutely. And if you aren't nodding, I mean, it is. It's a noble cause, right? We hear that. Well, what's the problem with that? If it's truly a noble cause and should take precedence, then a lot of people are going to be interested in it, folks, not just those who do it. You can't have it both ways. You can't say it's a noble cause, but it's none of your damn business how I do it. That's hypocrisy. So it's either not a noble cause and it's no more important than the tire shop down the road or the local bakery, or if it is, you need to open up to the fact that people want to know what you do and whether it's important or not. So a university of 15,000 in a rural area, Butte County, which is northern Sacramento Valley, about 80, 100 miles north of Sacramento, is basically almonds and walnuts, almonds if you aren't from there, almonds, walnuts, and rice in the valley, cattle and timber in the high country, and that's our county. But there's a population of 15,000 students thrust into a pretty small town that used to be an ag town, and where do most of them come from? San Diego, the Bay Area, and the L.A. Basin. They're getting away, and they think they really, it's like, what the hell is in Chico when they get there? Because it's a little town. And most of our students, not our ag students, but most of our students that I see come from a different environment and a different world. And that's where my experience has changed, where I think about how people view things. Things that I would have taken for granted and always have taken for granted. You know, semen testing bulls, you're going to put that up their butt? You know, I never thought, well, what's the deal? Been doing it for years. Not a big issue. Well, wait till somebody sees it who's never seen it before. Think it's not a big issue, right? Or, and you can pick any one of them, or castration, you know, dehorning. It doesn't matter. Those things, to us, it's like, yeah, that's common sense. Of course we do it. It's necessary. It's essential. I don't disagree with you. I'm not saying it isn't. I'm saying you need to get in somebody else's window and look. And if you make fun of it, you're in trouble, as far as I'm concerned. You are completely out of touch. If you laugh at people for their questions, then don't tell the story for me. Don't need it. You know, it's actually insulting to them when you make fun of them. And sometimes it's hard not to snicker. It really is. You got to constantly control yourself, not like, really? You really asking that? How many newspaper reporters from the student paper have came out to talk to me and do not understand why we aren't, it could be if they stop by the dairy to look at the beef and they don't know why we aren't milking the beef cows and all those kind of common sense things that all of us, and you can't snicker, folks. You got to get in their window. You got to respect different points of view. So real quick, how do we start to lose public trust, and have we? And I think this is one of the big challenges. Most of the time, all of us are trained, many of us are kind of science folks. A lot of us went to college, we're studying animal science or ag business, regardless what it is, or those, we want to go, what's the data tell us? Does that really cause pain? Come on, let's measure the pain, right? Okay. You don't think it causes pain to brand? Well, they don't feel it very much. Oh, just get off the time. Don't waste my time. Of course they feel it. You know, what we want to do is, I need a research study to find out whether castration hurts. Really? So I believe in science, and I want science to inform our discussion, and I particularly want it to inform our public policy. We need data. We need good data. So I'm not mocking that. I want that. But to use that as an excuse, I think, is unrealistic, because people don't really care how much you know until they know how much you care. This is really about trust and like. Because I teach a course, an agricultural systems and issues course, where we look at two sides of an issue. I say, go out and get the research. I want to see the data on both sides of this issue. And it could be the Endangered Species Act, and it could be water use in California. Get me the information. Guess what they come back with? Information on both sides of the issue that appear to be credible scientific sources. So which one do they believe? The one that matches their value system already, their window. Look, this will be a ranch kid. Look, I found out how the wolves ate some lambs. See, there's the data. They're bad. Look, I found some data that says wolves really help the ecosystem because they thin the elk. They're good. Didn't come from a ranch, right? So we find the science to support our beliefs. That's okay, but it's not a credible way to handle the issue. In what I would prefer you do is say, let's talk about the issue. And what we have to do, particularly in our small group of people that we are, is we have to build trust with people so they're comfortable with what we're doing, and then they're going to believe your science. Because that's really what it comes down to. Scientists, and it really bothers me, they can be bought. My science is better than yours. We run into that now, and that's unfortunate. Okay, this is the other one I get from the ranch kids. Of course we treat them well or we wouldn't make money, right? It's a profit thing. How many like that argument? Don't raise your hand, because I'm putting you on the spot. I used to use it. It's kind of common sense. Sure, you want us to lose money? Well, do you know how that sounds? It sounds like you really don't care about the animals, you care about money. And I don't know if that's true. I think we do care about the animals. Let me tell you the hardest one, and if you get the answer to this one, then you don't have to take the test at the end. You really say you like animals and treat them well, then how come you kill them and eat them? That's a tough one. To me, it's not. I mean, I've had to handle that on NPR. Shoot me. You know, that was an interesting challenge. I've had to handle that on NPR. In a radio with an activist who was concerned. And you have to really think about how you're going to handle that question and what you're going to say. And I'm okay. And maybe if we have time, we'll share my answer at the end. But I watch as we tell our story. We show the picture of the cute calf that we saw one this morning, you know, sucking a bottle and with a coat on or something, if you saw that. That's good. We care. Okay, now we're going to kill them and eat them. There is a disconnect there that we have to struggle with in terms of how we communicate that we can do both, and it's okay to do both, and we're comfortable with both, but you can't leave one hanging. So sometimes the way we present our story, I really struggle with the university because they want pictures, when they come to do the College of Ag, they want pictures of cute goats or cute baby lambs or cute calves on our homepage, and hopefully a name. I don't want to name them, and I don't want a cute picture. You know, it's a tough challenge to try and balance those two. So watch as you tell your story. All right. You know, I used to want to defend everything in agriculture because, damn it, that's just the way it is. You know, it's hard to criticize somebody, especially when you don't know the whole story, because I don't like somebody telling me you shouldn't brand cattle. right? So I don't criticize other forms of animal agriculture. But that doesn't mean I have to defend them either. Okay? I think we have to realize that there are evolving agricultural practices. And if you see something you're not comfortable with, that doesn't mean it's wrong, because you may not know the information, just about us. But it also doesn't mean you have to rush to the defense. You know the funny thing about a lot of this animal agriculture, rights, welfare, whatever you call it? We are already changing. And that's okay if we do it. We just damn well don't somebody tell us we have to. Is that right? And I feel the same way. So, in fact, if they tell us we have to, then we'll say we're not going to. See you in court. Right? If it was our choice, look how practices have changed over time with how we naturally have evolved, because we want to do things better. Doesn't every farmer and rancher want to do things better? That's part of who we are. So that natural evolution of let's make change is a good thing. But if somebody tells us you have to, then we've got an issue. And that's what we talked about. We can do better at everything that we do. You know, it doesn't, and I know, look how much now we see low stress handling workshops and different priorities in terms of how we're doing those things ourselves. And we shouldn't apologize for it. We shouldn't say we've been forced into it. We're doing it because it's the right thing to do. Have any of you ever been cruel to an animal? I don't know. How do you define that, right? We've all done things at times that we thought were the right thing to do that somebody else would perceive as cruelty. It's just part of it. You just have to recognize that our goal, my goal, would be let's do everything better. Let's move the bell curve. Let's not say, well, you can never do that again. Because you don't know when you're going to have to do that again, right? It's how do you move the bell curve? The other thing we like to do is attack people who disagree with us. What does that make us look like? We have something to hide and we're on the defense. I like to ignore. I think it's the next slide. Oh, we'll back up one. I kind of like to ignore the radical stuff. It just doesn't help. You know, give the public some credit. Just give them some credit. They know nutcases when they see them. You know, I think we overreact. And by so overreacting, sometimes we look a little radical. You know, just take a deep breath, take a step back, and say, who in the world doesn't know PETA's crazy? You know, it's just the way it is. And so we get too excited about the extremes. So just let's not attack everyone that we disagree with. Not being willing to listen, and I talked about that at the very beginning, and that's been the hardest one for me. I was gutsy enough, I won't do it again, by the way, but I actually invited the lobbyist from, this hurts me to say, from HSUS to one of my classes. It still gives me a stomachache to think about it. But it was, I mean, it's they needed to see, these are ag students, they needed to see what other people think, rather than just sit together and say we're all fine. And to be perfectly honest, she's very bright and a good speaker, and she doesn't always tell the truth, but it's important for people to see differing views. I didn't put this together. One of my female students did, I promise you. No one wants to be caged. She's the one who found that for me. Ignore the lunatics. Let them go. Work with that big part in the middle. This is where we tend to be, I think, the most guilty, is we tend to react to things. This was actually some medical students at UC San Diego, I believe. Protests are kind of, everybody likes a fight, don't they? That's when you show up. Anybody sit on like a school board or a community group, church group, rotary, whatever? When do people come to the meeting? When there's something to fight about. When there's something to fight about. So the idea of let's engage these people when they're pretty radical, I think is risky. And I don't think it makes a whole lot of sense to do that. I think you step back and let people, and we've done that. I'm guessing some of the other community or some of the other universities here, when those animal rights people show up on campus and hand out the same nasty pictures of the sows in the crates and the chickens being, you know, scald it alive. We just let them hand them out. You know what the Young Cattlemen's Association started doing? Having a tri-tip barbecue the same day. Guess who gets the bigger crowd? It's just positive. It's proactive. It's not reactive, and you don't worry about it. You have to really convince those students, let's not go to a debate and go one-on-one. Let's not go get in a fist fight. It doesn't mean you can't have a thorough discussion, but be cautious. This is another one that's a challenge for all of us, because someone disagrees with you does not make them stupid. Okay? And it also doesn't make them evil. Good people can look at the same issue from different ways, and that's a little bit of a struggle for all of us. Years and years ago, I taught an Animal Science 101 class, freshman GE course, where I would have students who took that. I'd have ag students in there, and I'd also have students who thought, I don't want to take biology, I'll take animal science, it sounds better. There was about 100 students in the class, and I had a young man who sat against the wall, and he had blue hair one day and red hair another day and a variety of piercings and tattoos. And he didn't seem like a bad kid, but something, you know, there was probably another organism that could use the oxygen more effectively. Okay? But he showed up enough, and I was pretty sure he was going to pass. And a nice young man, and never disrespectful, just kind of the, I don't know if he was stoned or not. I couldn't tell. I still can't tell. That's how old I am. I have no idea. But I remember pretty vividly, we were weighing pigs at the farm for part of his lab for a research project. And it was the day, this will tell, some of you weren't even born, I see some young people, it was the day of the Dole Clinton elections. Okay? 96, is that right? Is that right? 18 years ago? This kid, I wish I could remember his name, he's famous for the times I've told this story. And he comes up to me weighing pigs for his research project and he goes, you voted yet? And I thought, oh Christ, he knows how to vote. You know? This is really scaring me. No. We got a problem. I said, with any luck, he'll be a libertarian. Otherwise, we're in trouble again. And I said, no, have you? And he had his I voted sticker on. He goes, yeah. He goes, Dole all the way. I said, yeah, right. You're trying to win. You're trying to somehow get a grade out of me out of this class. And he goes, you think I'd vote for that no goddamn good Clinton draft dodging pot smoking son of a, you can get the rest of it? I was like, what? Well, it turns out he was an Orange County Republican. I don't know if you know what that means, but Orange County, California is a pretty wealthy area that probably raises more money for Republican candidates than he, and his dad was a whatever medical doctor who probably was wondering what had happened to his son. But the point was, is somebody was stereotyping, and it was me. It wasn't him. It was me. And it's a really good lesson for all of you. That doesn't mean I think you should go embrace the homeless people with tattoos and earrings, but I do think we better be careful about how quickly we judge others and then wonder why we are judged. And it's so natural to do and so hard not to. And those stereotypes will fit 90% of the time, but it's the 10% of the time you're dead wrong that you missed an opportunity. You missed an opportunity to be engaged and to talk to people. So those are those little life lessons you kind of tuck away. Say, wait a second, be careful. You know, I have the other experiences I've served. I now serve in the role as an interim dean for a college, and I served on the Academic Senate. There aren't a lot of real conservative ranchers on that group. In fact, I may be the only one. In fact, I know I'm the only one. And I've figured out how to work with those folks, and they've taught me a lot about how to do things and how not to do things. But I've found allies in unusual places, people who I don't agree with on many, many issues. But we agree on one thing. We agree that students are first and foremost. Well, we have common ground now, so we can work together to do the right thing. I really think when people disagree with you, it's not about telling them they're wrong. It's telling them about finding common ground, a common place that you can work together. How are we doing on time? Oh, I'm okay. 15 minutes? Yeah. Good. I'll keep talking. I got lots of stuff. We don't work hard enough to include coalitions that, other than the public. I mean, California, we tend to want to sit down with, you know, we try and work, although it's not always easy to do with the dairy producers, not always easy. We try and work with the Farm Bureau, we try and work, but we really don't want to reach out too much. I think California Cattlemen has tried and does a nice job with trying to do that. But agriculture in general, we want to rely on each other, and when we do that, for good reason. It makes good sense. It makes it difficult for us to bridge to other groups because we're always worried about who we're going to offend along the way. But at least reach out. And I'm not talking on an association level. I'm talking on an individual level. You know, where are your allies? And who are they that you can talk to? And we have to be careful. We don't represent enough votes. I know in this room, certainly in this entire convention, we don't agree on a lot of things, I would guess. But sometimes I feel like we're Custer's last stand, and we all decide to turn inward and shoot. Right? You know, we can't figure out a common goal and a common idea that we can work with. And I think on the animal welfare one, it should be fairly easy. There's also a lot of tendencies to make fun of other kinds of production systems. And I don't care if that's organic or grass-fed or natural or somebody doing something different. You're saying, yeah. Or they will make fun of traditional systems. I don't have enough energy for that. Let it go. Let the market sort it out. If market works, market works. If we believe in free enterprise, just kind of step back. If people want to work into a free-range system with their chickens, I don't care. It's your choice. It's not me to tell them it's good or bad. The market will sort it. By the way, what do you pay for a dozen and a half eggs in one of your states? Anybody know their price? Anybody buy any? Somewhere around $3-4. Does that sound right? Does that sound right? You know what happened in January 1st in California? If you don't think there's consequences for social ethic and our perception of animals, Prop 2 went fully into effect in California, which means that caged hens, layers, by the way, not broilers, there's a lot of confusion there, they have to be able to stand up, turn around, stretch their limbs. They have to have that much space, which means, and California passed a law that eggs aren't going to come in from Iowa or other places that don't meet the same standards. So January 1, what was the price of 18 eggs? $6, went up $2. Changing social cost. Okay, so you say, well, now the public's going to reverse that. No, they aren't. No, they aren't. That was 5 years ago. If it goes to the ballot box, and I'm not just talking in California, if it goes to the ballot box on most issues, when you get to a statewide level, most issues, if they're well-crafted, agriculture will not succeed. And I don't want to even get into the ag-gag stuff because I don't have enough time. But there are cases and there are states that will happen, but just watch. California, I know noted as a liberal state, basically every, if you don't know much about there, there's three big cities, San Diego, the Bay Area, Los Angeles based and the Bay Area, they have the votes. It's kind of like many of your states. Chicago has the votes in Illinois, right? You know, you're controlled by those votes. In Prop 2, every county but one in California voted in favor of it. The very rural agricultural counties voted in favor of it. It wasn't just the Bay Area. We're like, wait a second. California, 2/3 of the people voted for it? Well, it was a reasonable thing. We want chickens to stand and be able to turn around. It was presented reasonably, and it carried, okay? And now it has a cost, but the cost is delayed, and I will assure you, if any of these issues get to the ballot, with a phased-in delay, or 6 years out, 8 years out, it's hard not to, because, well, we gave the industry time to adapt, right? We gave them time to change. It is interesting to see how it changes. The other thing, and I've got a few slides here since we have a little time, sometimes our leadership wants to tell us, and I'm not talking NCBA, I'm just talking in a local association or a state association or any group, this is what we're going to do. Be careful you're trying to lead a parade nobody's following. You know, see what your producers really think. And we did that. We surveyed some cattlemen, and very honestly, I know you say, well, they were California cattlemen. Be cautious. These were what I would say are a pretty progressive group of fairly large-scale cattle ranches and represented thousands of cows. Well, literally maybe hundreds of thousands. There's about 200 producers in the survey, and some of them were some of the larger producers in the country, and then there were some smaller ones. But we asked them some questions. See if we get the next one. Well, I'll show you this one, and then I'll come back to that survey. Let's focus a little bit on beef cattle welfare, and then I'll show you what producers think. What's the scope of the problem? What are our issues? Do we have extreme confinement? No. And feedlots have done a remarkable job. If any place has really embraced animal welfare, obviously the packing sector, but the feedlots have changed so many things in terms of how facilities and how they handle. They get the blame, but they're the progressive ones in this thing. Us cow-calf guys are the ones who kind of want to drag our feet. The feedlot folks have made tremendous improvements, whether it's dust control or health. They've made huge change. So if you ask the general public what are the big issues relative to animal welfare, if they can sort it out, confinement's the big one. That's the one they really key on and see. It looks bad. It must be bad. And we don't have extreme confinement. So that's good. We're okay. Do we have short-term pain? Yes. And the big four, if you look at HSUS's paper that they put out on beef cattle welfare, you might want to read it. The big four, castration, branding, dehorning, and earmarking. Followed by long-haul transportation. Whew, that would kill us in California. Don't want to get there. But those are the four that they literally put in their beef cattle welfare concerns. Doesn't that scare you just a little bit? There's short-term pain. You know when we're going to wake up and realize this is a real issue? When it's too late. I don't think we have to make a lot of change. We have to make slow, incremental improvements in what we do. Because you know what they call those practices? Castration, dehorning, branding, and earmarking. What's HSUS call? Mutilation. Not surgical procedures. Mutilation. You think that sells very well on a commercial? It's going to be like the factory farm discussion. It's too late. You are a factory, right? By the time we get around to thinking about this issue, mutilation will be the term that's used. You will not win on an issue that's called mutilation. You will not win. So we have an opportunity because it's not high on the radar yet. Good. Have you Google animal welfare or animal rights? What comes up? Dogs and cats, dogs and cats, dogs and cats. I love it. Whew. You got to hunt a little further down to find mercy for animals and saving the life. It's there. But it's not front and center, and it won't be front and center for a while. So that's the good news. We got some time to think about it. We got some time to do what we think is right rather than having somebody tell us what's right. I want us to be the ones who dictate any changes that come along. So we asked a few producers, this might surprise you, do animals have rights? I thought the answer would be no, right? Wouldn't you? Surprise? 2/3 of them said yeah. Because they don't define rights as life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness and the right to vote. They just think animals have the right to be treated humanely and ethically. That's why they're producers. The public's good with that definition. So am I. We asked them a few questions. What would you do if somebody stopped and took pictures or a video along the road where you're working cattle? Would you go engage them in conversation, tell them get the hell out of there? You know, what do you really want to do? And it's kind of an awkward one because, again, remember some of those routine practices that we do? Those routine practices? We just think they're natural. And can you imagine a busy highway and it's a rope and drag deal and everybody's drinking a bunch of beer and somebody breaks a leg on a calf and it happened to be somebody on the side of the road with a video camera? Doesn't mean you did anything wrong. It just means you really screwed up when it's posted on the internet. Right? We have to think about the things we do. And it doesn't mean we need to apologize for them. We need to just put them in context and make sure people understand them. This one was interesting. You know, the problem is if you wanted to stop cutting calves, where would all the Rocky Mountain oysters go to, right? Yeah. But you think about that. And see, and I made a joke of it. I wouldn't make a joke of that to consumers if I talked to them. If there's an economic and reasonable alternative to castration, would you adopt it? You know, about 47% said, sure, be one less thing I have to do if there was a way to do it. Now, don't worry, there currently isn't one. I'm not suggesting we should do that, but that's interesting to me, as opposed to, hell no, I won't. That's only 10% of the producers. And then I think most, I would fall into the approach cautiously. I don't want to be on the leading edge or the bleeding edge. You know, I would be there, I'd be considering, but I wouldn't do it right away. But it's interesting to see what producers think. Branding, now this is the West for us. I'm surprised we even got 42% to say yes. They're clearly not outside operations. They must be inside operations. And public lands operations would say no, you know, absolutely no. But it's interesting, but it says, you got to be careful, economic and reasonable alternative. economic and reasonable alternative. In my world, in the West, this would be the last domino to fall, and I think it would be probably with a war before it ever got there. You know, I don't think that's going away. But it's good to be thinking what our producers are telling us. This was interesting. You think cattlemen should talk with animal rights groups to try and reach an understanding? About half the people said yes. You know, I've done it. It's not a real pleasant experience, to be honest. But it's not a bad thing for you to at least realize producers want to see what they're thinking. Now, be careful. Talking and communicating may not mean the same thing again. Remember the story? You're going to talk or you're going to communicate? You're going to give and take. Remember the meeting? Was that Denver we said in the meeting? That was an interesting experience, wasn't it? Yeah. I like this one at the end. Do animals have the right to be raised and treated humanely? And that's producers. Who's the 6% who said no? I asked him. I went and found him. Just because I wanted to know. And he says, animals should be treated humanely, but I just don't like the word rights. I just don't like the damn word rights, because it sounds like we're trying to give them constitutional rights. So I'm not going to buy into it. Not going to deal with it. So now I think what I'd like to do, and I've got just a few minutes left, be careful with what are the solutions. Let's kind of take a step back and say, I don't think we're doing bad in beef cattle welfare. So the end of the story is I don't think we've necessarily lost the battle in animal welfare, because I don't know if it is a battle. I think it's progressive change and improvement. And don't get too far ahead of yourself. A colleague who shall remain nameless, I watched him give a talk one time who said, and some of you may guess who this is if you hear the analogy, but he said, there's an ox cart leaving to go from Fresno to Sacramento. You've got choices. You can run ahead of it to try and pull it quicker. You can walk beside it, or you can be drugged behind it, but it's going to get there. Where do you want to be? I'm kind of on that walking mood. I don't want to run, and I don't want to get drugged. But I want to be careful to know where the line is that I'm not going to get drugged across, right? But it's about making incremental change. So in summary, because we have time for a few questions, comments. In summary, I don't think we're doing bad. I think we're going to make incremental, important progress. You know, as we make change, I gave a talk similar to this to the International Animal Welfare Symposium in Iowa last summer, which was mostly veterinarians. Some of the proposed solutions aren't practical. It doesn't mean that they aren't looking for solutions, but to suggest that I'm going to have to inject every animal prior to castration with a painkiller ain't going to happen in our operation. Okay? So I don't want us to get too far out in front of what's practical reality, but that shouldn't keep us from exploring alternatives to see what may work and may not work. Understand regional and scale differences. You know, what's going to happen on 15 cows that are close in and you can see every day is going to be much different than it's going to happen on public lands or large operations. Literally, our cows calve in that country and I may not see them for 5 to 6 months. So am I cruel if one happens to have a backwards calf and die? I don't know. So what would be my argument? Well, it's a good, healthy environment. There's no parasites, and it's nature, and away we go. But, yeah, I'm not going to be there to help every one of them. You know, I don't think I'm going to get this right, and I don't think anybody gets it right. You've got to do what works for you to improve things. Stay on the positive. Take a long-term view of the situation. And we've been trying that in California. Dr. Talbot, I don't know if he made it in here, but we had an animal welfare task force that we worked with. He was CCA president and a practicing veterinarian and a rancher. And so this isn't about tomorrow. Oh, Daly said we got to get rid of castration and branding. That better not show up in print because I didn't say that. I said we need to be thinking 10 years down the road, what things can we do to present so our change is our change. It's not somebody telling us how to change. And that's a difference. Bring producers with you. This was to the vets. Understand what works on the ground. Learn from those in the field. Realize that production practices continually evolve. And what's your window on animal welfare? I would ask you to do one thing for me. How many of you actually know a fully urban person who doesn't agree with you and talk to them regularly? About 6, 10. We talk to each other that we agree with. And then when we talk to the urban person, it's like, you need to learn all about what I do. Come on, just chill. But listen to where they come from. I would be extremely uncomfortable. I had to go down and do the LA food dialogues. I don't know if any of you have seen those food dialogues. They're kind of cool. But they dropped me in LA, you know, go catch, you know, public transportation and get from here to there. I'm a lost ball in tall weeds. I don't function very well. So how can you expect them all of a sudden to come out and, oh, yeah, I understand what you're doing. Just back off. Let it go. But get to see where people are coming from. Just because it's your window doesn't make it right. List in your head the things that you could see happen on your operation that will be difficult to explain. Do not apologize for them. Don't say they're wrong. Just think about it and think about how they'll change. So in summary, I guess I'd say be careful what you reach for, because you might get it. This is last summer. My 16, now 17-year-old went somewhere, of course, which means dad feeds his steer that he's taken to the county fair. That's not right. I'm done with that. He's 17. The steer can go hungry, right? So I go out to feed his steer and reach down to the feed bag or whatever, the bucket that was there, and I put my hand on the little snake on the right and killed that one. And then after I stopped and cleaned my pants out, I went back to do the second one. Those are rattlesnakes, in case you aren't familiar with them, where you're from. And I didn't know there was a second one there, and there was a second one right by the bag. By then, it's like you're walking around looking, and it's getting dark. It's like I am in something in the barn, and I don't like this. But I killed the second one, and then I heard the third one. And those were the three snakes. It was kind of like that Billy Goat Gruff story with the little one and the bigger one and the bigger one. That's what I got with snakes. So be careful what you reach for. How it relates to animal welfare is we do need to think about what we do. We do need to tell our story, but I just, God, that grates on me when I hear it. How about listen to other stories? And if you're going to tell your story, don't be smug about it. Like, I'm sure I'm right and the rest of the world is wrong. It's perceived as smugness, arrogance. It's the rest of the world that's wrong and I'm right. Well, you may be, but don't be smug about it. Give people time to adapt to what you're doing. Think about the things that we can change and the things we can't. And I'm not ready to let any of the things we're doing go. But I'm wondering how I can do them better so I don't have to let them go. You know, am I doing them correctly? There's lots of programs out there. I mean, you see anything from the GAP program, the natural programs, to all kinds of different ways that people are embracing animal welfare in different ways. It is a social ethic that will be demanded by society, good or bad. We don't have to like it. If you don't want to participate, there's always commodity product. It's okay. Doesn't make you a bad producer at all. I don't participate in a lot of those programs because they don't fit for me in our operation. I don't have enough labor. One kid, me. It doesn't work that way. So in summary, I really like talking about this issue, and if nothing else, I would challenge you to go back and ask yourself, can I talk to someone, not at someone, to someone with a differing viewpoint? See if I can see where they're coming from and see who I can change and improve what I do. Thank you very much. Is there time for questions? Okay, I went fast enough, and I'll start telling stories if there aren't any questions, but we got about 5-6 minutes. Yes, sir, T. Wright.
Dave, this is in the category of be careful what you reach for. And you have in your survey, which I want to get from you, that we as an industry don't have too much confinement. And yet we have
universities
and we have producers right now who are actively advocating for total lifetime confinement of beef production. I put that in, and I may be smug, but I'm putting that in. You know, be careful what we ask for, and I think our industry is about to run into the wrong wall.
I don't know if you can hear T. Wright, but the idea that you are seeing occasionally printed that if we go to more confinement, we can be more efficient, we can do things better, right? We run great risk with the social ethic of the United States and I think eventually the world in terms of confinement. It's the story that's our best part of our story. It's the environmental, it goes hand in hand with our stewardship discussions. So I think you have to be really cautious to say that we're going to confine them more. With the caveat, I want to point out, and I didn't say it very loudly, We put a lot of Holstein calves in confinement at a very early age that are beef in our world. And that one, and I'm not saying it is the way to produce them. I'm not arguing about the production practice. Many of them have wonderful quality assurance programs. They do a great job of tracking. They have individual ID. It's still one that's very difficult from a palatable standpoint to show people when they're in the hutches, when the calf hutches. Once they get to the larger group pens, they're okay. But, yeah, confinement is a risky one, and I hope we can it's the part of the story I tell very clearly and easily when I'm on NPR, I promise you. Other questions or comments? Really? I didn't make anybody mad? What's your list? Yes.
I just have a comment. I went to high school with 60 other students, and our senior project was taking a chicken from birth to death. And we are a big ag-based small-town community, so we all assumed that everyone understood what it was. We all thought we were all on 4-H, you know, all my friends did the county fair. And we kind of ignored the two or three students that had questions or was like, we're going to kill these chickens that we just named. Well, when we got to the killing point, one of the girls, she stole her chicken from school. And, of course, that brought attention to PETA and the Kansas City Star newspaper. And so that made me realize, wow, I could have, you know, completely missed that, you know, bad part about that and, I guess, and answered her questions before that completely escalated out of hand. So I guess I could relate.
You can relate, and you've dealt with what some of us who've ran through these, and you can imagine, and that was in an ag community, deal with an urban population of students, the questions I get. And it does change how you think about how you phrase those things. You can't say, well, you're just an idiot. It doesn't work that way. So you think about that. So how would you answer that question? Can you raise them and eat them?
The word you should be using is harvest. We do not kill animals, we harvest.
You know, we can exsanguinate, slaughter, kill, butcher, murder, or whatever we want to do, harvest. And I say that only facetiously because we spend a lot of time worrying about the word. In the end, they're dead. Okay? In the end, they're dead. And we don't have to deny it. We don't have to like it. It is just a reality of what we do. I don't think the word is the important one. The question is, did that young lady develop enough trust that she could understand why that would happen? And that is difficult. We watch it through the 4-H and FFA where they become... How many of you go to the junior livestock auction and watch them crying their eyes out? Just drives me crazy. My kids cried if they didn't get enough money. You know, it's just a different perspective. Somebody had their hand up. And we'll... Time for one more? Yeah, go ahead.
We're from Northeast Florida, and we have an educational program as well there on our ranch. We have a cow-calf operation. And some days we'll have 300 head of kids come to our ranch.
300 head of kids, I like that.
We'll have children come out there, and we teach them from farm to table. And one of the activities that they do is they get on a wagon, and they go out to the cow pasture, and the cows come up to their hands, they cow the stuff on their hands. And then after they do the cow pasture, we explain them that those are beef cows.
Yeah.
They would much rather hear that those are dairy cows.
Yeah. We eat dairy cows, too. People just tend to forget it.
And that's explained to them as well. But the way we explain it to them is that we wouldn't have this operation. If they don't eat the cows, we wouldn't have the operation there. And we kind of explain it in a way that the children can handle it. And most of the children at a young age, with them coming out there, they understand it a whole lot better than the adults do. So I think if we can educate children at a young age, which I think that our country...
Thank you. Sounds like she's got a great program of bringing kids to the ranch and educating there. All those little pieces help. I will tell you, though, that what happens is realize that they will go into a dark tunnel after they're about 5 and come out when they're 25, you hope. And that's kind of the university system because we did a demonstration years ago at the university in the free speech area. Imagine they called it a free speech area. But it was we brought live animals in there, and you could see these group of students circling around in the back. And, you know, it's kind of those. They were worried about the shade. They were worried about the heat. And they were trying to figure out a protest, trying to figure out how to get the newspaper there. And so I have no idea why I did it, but I don't know why. But I went up and shook their hands and introduced myself and asked them who they were and where they were from. It changes the dynamic. It changes the dynamic when you're right by them and you're shaking their hand. Say, where'd you get your views? Not telling them they're wrong. Don't even bother. It is not what you're there for. You aren't changing their mind by getting louder. just to have a discussion. Turned out a couple of them were 4-H kids who showed steers once before, and they were just experimenting when they were in college, and you know, they got some new ideas, and they'll come out of the tunnel. It's okay. Don't get too excited about it. Just be good to them. Show that you're a good person. Show that you can be trusted. Don't try and tell people they're wrong. And don't assume that just telling them the facts makes a difference at all. You know, facts is what we want to hang our hat on. I'm trying to tell you it's about trust. You can switch that. Facts are fine, but people don't want to be lectured to. Students are a different group. Got time for one more? Yep, go for it.
Just a comment.
We had breakfast together, didn't we? I saw her at the table. Now you didn't know I was going to come here and make a jerk of myself. Go ahead. Thank you.
I'm a big piece from Australia. I don't know if you're across the line export debate in Australia.
I have. I've got friends over there.
Fantastic example of the power of the animal welfare concern. Not just the extreme guys, but public interest in animal welfare. With a huge live export industry, they take millions ahead of wild animals across on boats to Indonesia. A TV crew went into one of these slaughterhouses in Indonesia, got graphic footage of a beast being slaughtered in Namri, Australian animal that had been sold to an Indonesian company. This footage went viral, and within 8 to 10 days, the government stepped in, our government stepped in and shut down the industry.
Shut down live export.
That industry, and there are good family farms that went out of business on the back of that decision.
One video.
Since been reinstated, a lot of work's been done to get those assurances back on track. But that's the power, not at the extreme end. That was kids and mums and dads, everyday people with a concern about animal welfare.
People run to a fire. And 100 good stories and 100 good lessons are offset by one of those videos. If I see that damn Holstein cow with a forklift in California one more time, on every time they need to raise money, that commercial is on the website. And you've probably seen the same damn cow. She's very famous. And I'm sure the same with the one that was the live, I saw that video of the live export in Indonesia. But with that said, it's up to us to police. Those things still happen. They're going to happen on our own operation. Can you cut them down? Can you reduce the number of those opportunities for the bad videos to occur? You've been a great audience. I think we better cut it off. I'll see some of you at lunch if I didn't ruin your lunch.